You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony. Good evening and welcome to Talk of the Bay. I'm your host, Rick Kleffel on Talk of the Bay. Tonight, Michael Anisimov, the media director of the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, we're going to be talking about what happens when man and machine become one or indistinguishable from one another, or when we just become food. It's the Singularity coming up on Talk of the Bay. Stay tuned. Michael Anisimov, media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Thanks, Rick.
So let's ratchet back and get an idea of, talk a little bit about just the history of artificial intelligence. It's not something that's always been around, has it?
No. Basically, it seems like it came out of an influential group of intellectuals and academics in the mid-60s, started to realize that programming a computer could be taken to the level of automating certain things that were thought to be the domain of humans forever, like mathematical proofs. And then the field called artificial intelligence got started, and ever since then it's been a really bumpy ride. And it seems to be kind of like a label that people take when they want to describe something that's complex software and they're really looking for investor dollars.
Well, it's interesting, this original group, their conception of artificial intelligence was, not surprisingly, based on the things they did well. Now, artificial intelligence was people who could do chess, problem solving, math. But as we've come through the ages, I mean, artificial intelligence proves to be a lot of things that are not so easy. And in fact, playing chess and math problems are probably some of the easiest stuff that you can do, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that things that 3- and 4-year-olds can do, like throwing a ball and swinging a bat and actually hitting the ball and bat, are complex computations that we've just begun to like determine the mathematical structure of.
Now, one of the things that's interesting is there's two different kinds, and you alluded to this a little bit. I'd like you to explain to me the difference between artificial general intelligence and artificial intelligence, because this is, I think, a really a key concept to understand where we are now and maybe where we want to be.
Well, artificial general intelligence would be a computer that can, it has intelligence that's as general as human beings. So we'll be able to solve problems that the programmer has never determined in advance, just in the same way that a child can solve problems that the parent might not have determined in advance. It would be a software program that can do anything human beings can do and possibly even more. So that's a really ambitious goal. Whereas artificial intelligence today can refer to something as simple as a program that automatically checks credit card transactions to see if there's been fraud.
So in other words, the artificial general intelligence, I think this is what most people think of when they hear the words AI. They think of HAL 9000, you know, the little red dot in the spaceship, you know, I'm sorry, Dave, you can't come in. But that's not it, is it? We're not there yet, are we?
We're not there yet, but it seems like that was the initial vision mm-hmm. in 1965, and they said, oh, we'll have this wrapped up in like 10 or 15 years, no problem. And that's not quite how it went. So no. There's been like little bumps here and there where progress has been encouraging, and the consensus is that the so-called AI winter is done right now. But we still have a long way to go to human equivalence. But one of the points that my organization is making is that human equivalence is possible, and it's a goal worth striving for.
Well, tell us a little bit about, what do you mean by human equivalence? I mean, what is an is it a robot?
It wouldn't necessarily need to be a robot. Well, there's a great amount of debate on this issue, whether or not a artificial intelligence would need to be embodied in order to match all of human capabilities. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could have an avatar in a virtual world that would, first of all, be a cheaper place to develop artificial intelligence instead of using robotic bodies. So it seems more likely that true artificial intelligence or more advanced artificial intelligence would emerge in some sort of an online world.
Now, when we think about artificial intelligence and developing it. We have this vision of a computer, you know, a kind of an Einstein in a box. But it proves, as you alluded to a little bit earlier, that, you know, a toddler in a box is a lot harder goal, isn't it? So talk about this kind of new slant on artificial intelligence. And when did this come about? I mean, aren't we still trying to just pile as many chips as we can into these giant parallel arrays?
Oftentimes, yes, especially when it comes to things that involve a lot of really low-level calculations, like protein folding, it's just get as much hardware in a room as you can. But the question, like, everyone in artificial intelligence knows it's not a question of hardware, it's all a question of software. You can't put a bunch of computers in a room together and expect to create intelligence. What's needed is to analyze intelligence in a rigorous way and see if, in the same way that there are underlying principles of flight, maybe there might be underlying principles of intelligence that we could put into a machine to make it generally intelligent. And by general intelligence, I mean things like social skills, creativity, inspiration, all those somewhat, not really ineffable, but somewhat mysterious to us now, qualities that make humans human, make us clever and extremely flexible in the way we solve problems and come up with concepts.
Well, one of the things that's difficult to understand, and NPR was just talking about this now, is how we learn and how we teach. And that's one of the important things that computers are still having some problems with that, aren't they?
They certainly are, like in a lot of funny ways sometimes. It's kind of, you can only tell how magnificent human intelligence is when you see like the ridiculous mistakes that robots make. And
well, what are some of those mistakes?
Well, I heard an anecdote from my friend where there was a medical robot in a Stanford research facility, and he was not a professor yet, but he was a grad student at the time, and would get into an elevator with this robot, and the robot would jerk suddenly. It was a robot that would carry around medical supplies to give to like the patients in the building, and since it's Stanford, they were, you know, up to the minute in terms of like the robotic technology. And when he was in the elevator with the robot together, it made like a sharp turn that practically like slammed his arm. And at that point on, when he returned back to that location like 10 years later, he saw a sign of this door that said, "Do not enter the elevator with the robot." So like something that a robot would fail at, just noticing whether a human being is like a foot away from it.
Well, this is really interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about what this notion of the singularity is, because it's kind of slippery, and it involves some concepts that are kind of hard to wrap your brain around. So who first came up with this idea? There's a couple of competitors, aren't there?
There are. Like, it's most easily divided into three main ideas, which kind of compete with one another rather than synergize. Hmm. The first is the idea of an intelligence explosion, which was introduced by the mathematician I.J. Goode in, mid-century. And he called it intelligence improving intelligence. So if you had an intelligent machine, or even possibly like an enhanced human, maybe with the aid of computers, designing further forms of intelligence enhancement in a recursive cycle that keeps going and starts to run away, you call that an intelligence explosion. That was the first idea associated with a singularity.
Now, this is the idea that you make a computer that's as intelligent as a human, that's good, as not just as intelligent as a human, but as intelligent as a human who designs computers. Mm-hmm. That computer designs a computer better than itself. The computer it designs a computer better than itself. And this happens faster and faster till somewhere down the line, there's a computer that looks at you and says, "Why am I bothering?"
Well, I don't know about the last part, but there could be, yes, being at the end that is a lot more than we bargained for at the start of the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wouldn't necessarily have to be artificial intelligences in that scenario. It mm-hmm. could also be human beings using neuroengineering or brain-computer interfaces, or even like some chemicals that maybe increase the firing rate of our neurons with each other. You could have a scenario where human beings spark that initial feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
And there could be a scenario where there's a blend of the two also.
Mm-hmm.
So going on to the second definition of the singularity mm-hmm. would be Werner Vinge's idea, which is what he came up with the word singularity to describe it, which is the notion that once we create an intelligence smarter than humanity, it will be like the history of mankind is going into like a new realm, just in the same way that a cosmological black hole is a different realm than the area around it. The laws of physics as we know them can't be used to describe a black hole. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a black hole is fundamentally indescribable. It just means our current model breaks down. And that would be the same thing that might happen to the future in a world with greater than human intelligence.
Now, Werner Vinge is a science fiction writer. He's also a mathematician. And he first proposed this idea in a science fiction story, didn't he?
Well, you know, he informally proposed it there, but he did formally propose it at a NASA conference in 1992. So it's funny like how the formal and informal interplay there.
This is an interesting one of the things that I think when we start talking about the singularity and artificial intelligence in general is we start talking about science fiction as if it's science fact, and the two become really blurred. It's difficult to tell because, and I think this speaks to the singularity itself, because the rate of change is so fast. We might say something tonight that tomorrow is invalidated by a new piece of technology or a new discovery.
That's true, but over my years of thinking about the singularity, I've come to view it more as a potential discrete event, and I like to look at technological acceleration as a separate phenomenon that is closely related but still not quite the same thing.
So you said there were three versions of the singularity. The second is Werner Vinge's. So what's the third?
The third is Kurzweil's idea of exponentially accelerating technology, which in the last few years has become the standard definition of the singularity. And at times, like, I'm a little concerned that it's too expansive, that it just means technological progress in general. So when people argue about the singularity, sometimes it seems like they're just arguing about whether technological progress in general is a good thing. But I think the singularity should specifically refer to the creation of smarter than human intelligence, either in a machine or an enhanced human brain.
Now, this creation of this smarter than human intelligence, you think it's going to be a discrete event. Are you alone in this? I mean, talk about how the community of scientists that you associate with feel about this, because I think one of the things that's interesting about the Singularity Institute, and we'll get to the Institute itself in a minute, is just that there's a polyglot. It's like an almost a United Nations and about as effective and about as coherent as the United Nations in terms of points of view of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's why I'm somewhat encouraged that people are, including academics, are starting to get more optimistic about artificial intelligence, because I think that'll bring rigor to the area that so desperately needs. Otherwise, you're right, it's just a cacophony of voices going this way and that. But part of the role of my organization is to fund academic research into like delineating the concepts and making it something more concrete and academically respectable and something that can be analyzed with facts instead of just science fiction or speculation.
Well, tell us about the Singularity Institute. When did it come into being? Why? And who created it?
The Singularity Institute was founded in 2000 by Eliezer Yudkowsky, who at the time was 18 and had a lot of attention as being sort of like a child prodigy. And he, in cooperation with Brian and Sabine Atkins, who were a couple of VCs, came to the idea that the singularity might go badly, or the things that humans do prior to the singularity could have an impact on the ultimate outcome. So with that in mind, he wanted to create an institute to finance what we would call seed AI, which is what you described earlier, the notion of an artificial intelligence designed explicitly for self-improvement and reflectivity. And that's some of the basic problems in decision theory that we're working on now come to bear on that. So over the years, since 2000, we've also served as a kind of public advocacy and education group, holding the Singularity Summit since 2006. Every year to bring together a lot of scientists to discuss some of these issues. And there are scientists discussing all three of the singularity definitions that I put forth. So we serve as both a research think tank and as a public education organization.
Well, now, this is very interesting, but I have to draw attention to something you mentioned. They were worried that the singularity might go badly. Mm-hmm. Science fiction has lots of visions of this. I'm thinking, you know, you think of the Forbin Project or Harlan Ellison's I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Or there's a number of Stanislaw Lem stories that also focus on this. Talk about what you mean by badly. I'm concerned that I don't really want to be thought of as food. Or you can even Matrix.
Yeah, I think it's both a blessing and a curse that science fiction makes such a big deal about artificial intelligences going awry. I think that it's bizarre the way that people react to artificial intelligence. It seems as if they project their own motivations onto what future artificial intelligence will be like. So say that I love or I value love for my fellow human beings more than anything else in the world. Well, then I'll say, well, an artificial intelligence, if it became smart enough, would realize that being friends with all the people in the world and bringing them all close together would be the ultimate thing to do.
Machines of loving grace.
Yes. And on the other side, there are people who are like, oh, I'm in it, you know, for me. And like they may explicitly or implicitly believe that it's a dog-eat-dog world. So they assume then that means that artificial intelligence will act like a disgruntled human being when it's smarter than us. We're asking it to do our chores, for instance. But I think the real way we should analyze it is from more of like an evolutionary psychology, decision theory from the ground up perspective. Instead of making assumptions about the way that a non-human mind might think, we should study the history and the facts about human minds and all the complex structure we have. And a lot of that structure comes from having evolved as hominids on the African savanna for hundreds of thousands of years. But we don't realize that because since we all have a lot of the same mental features in common, we just don't reflect on them.
Well, this sounds like the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. It has its hands in a lot of pots because you're talking about evolutionary biology as being an important component of understanding how the singularity could come about just by virtue of the fact of how we come about. So talk about bringing together some of these diverse areas of scientists. I mean, do these people want to talk to one another? And if they do want to talk to one another, do they want to talk to one another about the singularity?
That's difficult to say. We are the pioneers in getting people from different fields talking to each other about some of these issues. And because they're so interdisciplinary, that's why we consider it so important to attract the attention of academics from areas like evolutionary biology, evolutionary psychology, decision theory, mathematics. It's like a laundry list of different areas that we are interested in getting attention from. But we recently wrote up a lot of proposed grants, and some of those grants are for papers that connect with different scientific fields, including evolutionary biology. And the way that it has an impact is that everything we know about the human mind seems to come from the way that was constructed by evolution. And when we're talking about artificial intelligence, it would be a being constructed by a fundamentally different process, which is human mm-hmm. design. And there's never been an intelligence that's been constructed by intelligent design, unless, see, there's obviously debate on that. Most scientists believe that life and intelligence has evolved without any intervention. So people might consider our minds to be messy solutions to evolutionary challenges. And especially organisms that evolved in a Darwinian ecology tend to compete a lot with each other, and they tend to kiss up and kick down, basically. And if we were to instill those same cognitive features into an artificial intelligence that grew a lot smarter than us, then we might be kind of screwed.
One of the things, it sounds like we might be the very dull butter knives that invent some very sharp razor blades that can slice us to ribbons and maybe use us again for food.
Yeah, and some people say, oh, it's too complicated. I'm just going to throw up my hands and like let the chips fall where they may. But one of the points that we're trying to make is that if we create artificial intelligence from the start with altruism and benevolence and positive values in mind, we might increase the chance of a positive outcome. It seems like most people are clustered into it'll definitely hate us, or it'll definitely think we're boring, or it'll definitely love us. But there aren't that many people who actually seem to acknowledge that the ultimate way it behaves might in some way be contingent on the way we program it.
Now, could you talk, how much influence does your institute have? I mean, in the world of science, as you said, there's a lot of people out there who are out to make a buck. And if you invented a self-improving artificial intelligence, that would be worth quite a bit of money. And you might say, to heck with this, you know, peace and love. I want, you know, profit and bonuses and create something that is perhaps very friendly to you, but not so friendly to everybody else. I mean, how are you reaching out to, say, the people who are writing software for the stock market, to analyze the stock market? I mean, that seems like a place, or even, as we know, Google, they say don't be evil, but they might not necessarily know what evil is, or might not know until it's too late.
Well, I'm proud to announce that we do have supporters within Google and in financial quant fields, so there are people that sympathize with us in those areas. But that's why we have events like the Singularity Summit, which are very media friendly, and we an article on the possible dangers of artificial intelligence showed up on the front page of the New York Times earlier this year. So mm-hmm. We're starting to see a lot more mainstream attention towards it, and we've seen that in the responses that we've gotten over the last year, especially, that a lot of people are concerned and are reaching out to us, at least tentatively, to talk about these issues.
It's almost as if we're beginning to realize that there's an ecology of computing, and we need to understand that we've never even thought that there would be an ecosystem, but that there actually is an ecosystem, and within that ecosystem there's some kind of evolution taking place, and we best figure out what it is before it turns into something quite unpleasant.
Yeah, I mean, throughout all of human civilization, we've always been making smarter tools, better things, more memory, more intelligence, this, that. And because human beings are merely, we're not magical, and I don't believe that we are like transcendent beings. I think that we're merely complex physical structures that just happen to be really damn good at thinking, imagining, and all that other stuff. So if we keep improving our tools, yes, at some point they will be able to match all of our capabilities and then streak past us. And I think that we can benefit by riding the wave rather than denying that it's coming.
Well, let's talk a little bit about more the nuts and bolts of the Singularity Institute. It was founded in 2000 by an 18-year-old genius and his cohorts. Now, how many people belong to it? It's based out of Stanford, right?
No, it's based in Santa Clara.
Oh, Santa Clara. Okay.
Yeah. So. We have 6 full-time employees and a large community of volunteers and visiting fellows. This summer, we began a visiting fellows program where we invited 11 researchers, mostly grad students in computer science or philosophy, from schools like Stanford, Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, Yale, and we brought them all together and did research for a summer and came up with some interesting papers that were presented at various computing and philosophy conferences, and a web app that allows people to analyze probability distributions over future events. So we've started, even though we only have 6 full-time staff, we have begun a permanent program of visiting fellows where people come for like 2 to 3 month stints, and we're expanding rapidly.
Now, are you a privately owned firm, a nonprofit? What?
Nonprofit.
You're a nonprofit. Okay. So I guess this is what we want, the people who are developing the artificial intelligence to be a nonprofit. Talk about how, you know, the 6 of you who are essentially maybe standing in front of the end of the world, standing between humanity and that which will consume it in a heartbeat for lunch. Talk about how you know you see scaling up. I mean, this seems like this is a I mean, we have the world is immersed, for better or worse, in an internet that essentially, you know, lots of science fiction writers have the first artificial intelligence being born running around out there somewhere. I mean, how involved are you in, I guess, the worldwide administration of the internet? I mean, it seems like something you'd want to be deeply and intimately involved in.
Not at all. And I'm somewhat skeptical of that scenario, actually, because I think that it views intelligence as a somewhat magical thing that will emerge if you put enough functional parts together. Like, for instance, would you ever expect a fully functional automobile to come out of like a junkyard experimentation? Probably not. It seems like artificial intelligence would most likely emerge as a well-funded, well-directed project. It's not something that I think will be created by accident. I think that makes a good science fiction story, but I'm skeptical about it in reality. If it were true, I would hope that the people who are managing the internet would take a look at it, but that's simply too big for us to deal with at our current size.
Okay, well, what exactly do you guys do? Let's talk a little bit about the Singularity Summit. So there have been three, am I correct?
Four.
Four, okay. Well, tell us what they are, where they are, and what gets accomplished at them.
The Singularity Summits are an effort to bring together scientists, academics, and futurists to speak about the concept of the singularity as construed broadly. And the first one we had was at Stanford in 2006. And we've had a lot of the, I guess you could say, the titans of tech and philosophy at our conference. For instance, Douglas Hofstadter, the author of Gödel, Escher, Bach, is considered a legend among computer programmers. And Rodney Brooks, who's considered to be one of the foremost roboticists in the world. And people come and speak about accelerating technology, robotics, artificial intelligence. And in the last year, we've even spread into areas like decision theory, collaborative science, and quantum computing. And it's partially just to have a dialogue between scientists on these intense areas. But for our research, we are much more narrowly focused. We focus on specific open problems in decision theory that would be useful to progress forward on artificial intelligence if they were solved.
Well, one of the things I thought interesting, I attended the 2007 Singularity Summit. And one of the things I thought was most interesting was the work being done on Baby Blue, the idea of creating the, you know, artificial toddler, as it were, which I think is I think that's a great place to start. And it's a place that if we start building something from that perspective, it seems to me that it offers more hope of a hopeful outcome.
Possibly. Yeah, it's difficult to... The magic of like a toddler is that their brain seems pre-configured to unfold into like an adult intelligence, and it's very difficult to determine exactly how that is. But if we did create artificial intelligence that started off like a toddler-level intelligence, it certainly would help us impress values upon it that are human-friendly without getting out of control too quickly.
Now, I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about working in virtual worlds, and the virtual world is growing all the time. Could you talk? I know that there's a lot of work actually being done in some of these gaming communities. Could you talk about some of that work?
Sure. Our director of research, Ben Gertzel, mm-hmm. has a LLC, Novamente, that is working to create more intelligent pets for Second Life. So one of his ideas is to create an artificial parrot that hears what people say and repeats it back and changes what it says based on positive or negative feedback. And it could also like tap into the global mind of parrots in Second Life, for instance. So you could share feedback information among these artificial pets. And I think that's an interesting idea for moving forward on artificial intelligence because it provides such a rich kind of like test bed. And that's one of the complaints that a lot of people that are in favor of the embodied view of AI put forth. They say, no matter what virtual world you create, it won't be as rich as the real world. And I think that we still aren't nearly at virtual worlds that are as rich as the real world, but we're starting to get there with Second Life.
I'm speaking with Michael Anisimov. He's the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. You're listening to Talk of the Bay. We'll be back in just a moment. Let's get back to Talk of the Bay and my guest, Michael Anisimov. He's the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Michael, let's talk about some of the stuff that came up at the last Singularity Summit. We had Ray Kurzweil talking about the ubiquity and predictability of the exponential growth of information technology. And Ray is big on the math, isn't he? He's very much looking at this as a math problem, where we know what the solution is. We know when the singularity about is going to arrive, at least according to his math.
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical of a lot of his calculations because I think he might be a little too quantitative. Just because a trend has continued on for some time doesn't necessarily mean that it will extend forever. One of the points that Ray Kurzweil makes is that a lot of different technologies seem to be improving exponentially. And I think that he is right on a lot of those, but not necessarily everything. For instance, computing power has been improving exponentially at about a rate of every 2 years, it doubles. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the quality of our software improves every 2 years. And there's a lot of really important metrics to people that don't improve every 2 years. It seems like almost everything that can't be quantified doesn't improve at the exponential rate. So there's a lot of people that are understandably skeptical of many of his arguments. But in general, I think he makes the argument that it seems like technology is speeding up. It might not be exponential, but it does seem to be getting faster.
What kind of dates are we looking at here?
Well, Ray Kurzweil, it's kind of unusual. He says that a computer will pass the Turing test, meaning that it will become indistinguishable from a human being over a chat channel in 2029. But that the fabric of our understanding won't be torn until 2045. Myself, I think that that human-level artificial intelligence, if it's going to happen at all, will probably happen within the next 100 years. But other than that, I think that I would probably err more towards the lower end of that, maybe like within 50 years. But it's completely uncertain. We're talking about an ambitious, long-term project where anything could come up and delay us.
And one of the important aspects of determining whether or not we have a human level artificial intelligence is our own lack of understanding of our own intelligence. So a lot of this comes back on how finally we can improve our mirrors.
That's true, but I also think that some people take that too seriously. For instance, they assume that for us to achieve artificial intelligence, we'll need to be able to interact with each other perfectly smoothly without any social awkwardness or uncertainty. And that's never going to happen because the world is imperfect and messy. But
And imperfection is desirable.
Indeed, it is. So I think that what we need to understand is not necessarily all the fine details of human intelligence, but just the fundamental underlying principles of intelligence, which the human mind in some way taps into in which we don't know. And just for a quick example, for instance, muscles. We use muscles to walk around, take action and stuff, but there are mechanical things that can achieve many of the same criteria that muscles can, like levers, and they might be more limited in some ways, and it's possible that the first artificial intelligences that are approximately human level will be like that as well. But we didn't need to copy the architecture of a bird in order to create flying machines. We were able to understand the underlying principles and tap into them to create what we want.
I like this idea of under the underlying principles. It's something I hadn't heard before. So could you talk about, is there any rigorous academic pursuit of these kind of underlying principles? I mean, when you bring this stuff to universities, do they just say, the science fiction department's over there?
No. There's actually a lot of interest in what's called Bayesian probability theory, where they use math to determine the optimal way to update beliefs based on incoming evidence. Hmm. And a lot of it are toy problems, like you have, you're picking like different colored stones out of an urn, like black and white, and say you pick like 10 white stones and 5 black stones, you can use this math to determine the probability that the next stone will be a certain color. And this Bayesian probabilistic math has been applied to all sorts of tasks that the human mind performs. There's even a computational cognitive neuroscience, I believe it is, computational cognitive neuroscience lab at MIT that looks into some of these issues. And there's a lot of leading schools that look at human intelligence through a mathematical lens.
Now, are you guys like the clearinghouse for all this stuff? Or is that what you want to be? Is that what is needed? Do we need a clearinghouse, or do we need to just put a bunch of pointy-headed geniuses in high-tech labs and hope that one of them flips the magic switch?
I think that it's such a huge problem, and we're so early in the task of creating artificial intelligence that we need as many people as we get, and the idea of a centralized clearinghouse is silly. But if we could make our voice be heard on any one area, I think it would be to exercise caution in artificial intelligence development, because once we create an artificial intelligence of a certain complexity and capability, it might be hard to get rid of it.
This, I think we're back to Colossus and the Forven project again, which may prove, we hope will not prove to be a prophetic movie. I mean, couldn't you just pull the plug? I mean,
well, see, there's these things nowadays called Trojans, worms, malware, viruses. It seems that if an artificial intelligence wanted to be free, it could probably send viruses that helped it run itself on lots of different computers in the same way that zombie networks work today.
This doesn't sound good, and I can see why we want to exercise caution. I think it's really interesting that the approach, I mean, and even down to the slogan, which is, you know, the threat and the promise of artificial intelligence, you know, acknowledges this, you know, kind of potential apocalypse that's contained within this field.
Yeah, it's one thing that's difficult for people to talk about sometimes is the notion of artificial intelligence independently transitioning to the real world and becoming a real world threat. And I think that when we're talking about several decades down the road, which I think is how long it'll take us to create real AI, we're going to have a different manufacturing base than the one we have now. It seems likely that it'll be more decentralized in the same way that music and file sharing decentralized a lot of other media. We're starting to see at-home fab labs, they're called, where mm-hmm. people use these machines to fabricate the hardware that they want, and they share open source models and things like that.
3D printers.
Exactly. So in maybe 20 years down the road, or even 10 years down the road, we'll see a lot more capable 3D printers. And if an artificial intelligence that is human level or beyond were hooked up to one of these things, I think the distinction between the virtual and the physical would break down really quickly.
Well, this is, I mean, the more you speak of this, the more frightened I become. So, I mean, but when you talk about these kind of apocalyptic scenarios, it starts to sound a little bit like conspiracy theory or, you know, again, like science fiction, and then it gets kind of quickly brushed aside. So how do you, who are working at this, you know, trying to urge caution and also urge hope too, and urge some forethought as people approach this problem of creating an artificial intelligence, how do you create a credibility when you talk to people, when you talk to, you know, universities and scientists?
Well, one of the things that has been somewhat of an accusation is that the idea of AI running amok is only a popular concern. But we've actually seen it being echoed more by academics. And how do we increase our credibility? Well, in the last year, there have been two advances in AI that are interesting. One is an artificial intelligence that can design its own scientific experiments and run them. And
really?
Yes.
Where did this happen? Who did it? And what did it do?
It was in England, and it just ran some simple biological experiments. And the idea was mainly like toy examples, but the idea would be that it could be extended in the future. And
this sounds like something that is learning.
It all depends on your definition of learning, but I think that one example that will increase our credibility, like in the years to come, is we'll start to see artificial intelligences and software programs that behave in ways we hadn't intended them to. For instance, in South Africa, I think it was in the last year, there was a autocannon, a turret that it was a mortar turret that fired off prematurely due to software glitch and killed 7 people. And so we see a lot of that happening. We're starting to see this happen a little more and more, where when we create computer programs, they follow the letter of our commands and rules, but they might not follow the spirit of our commands and rules. And because we're used to dealing with other human beings that implicitly we expect to understand the spirit of what we say, we treat robots the same way, and it just won't work because everything needs to be spelled out in extreme detail for robots, AIs, any artificial construct to do what we want it to do.
Well, this sounds like a burgeoning... one of the things that interests me is that you've alluded to a few times is that bringing in philosophers, and it seems like one of the a growth industry, so to speak, for the next few years as our unemployment creeps upward is in computational ethics.
Yeah, and we talk about the potential long-term downsides and upsides of like changing the human species or introducing intelligences greater than ourselves, but in the short term, we're dealing with, you know, military predator drones, increasing robotization of the battlefield, and a lot of issues that are knocking on our door right now. And there are academics that work specifically in what's called roboethics, that computational ethics, you could call it. And there is dialogue between our institute and academics in that. And I've met and talked to a lot of these people, and we see a lot of common ground.
This was, I spoke with a gentleman, Jay Storrs Hall, who had worked on this a bit. This goes quite a bit beyond the three laws of robotics, which still seem to hold some power and sway, at least over our imagination, if not over the actuality. I mean, are these things, these three laws, you know, are they taken seriously within the world of robotics, or?
Absolutely not. Those three laws are like the bane of our existence, actually.
Really?
Because they're so simplistic that they were specifically written to fall apart. Mm-hmm. The three laws are one, do what humans say. What, do you remember the three laws?
Two, do not harm a human and do not allow a human to come to harm through inaction, I think is right.
Yeah,
mistaken.
And it just sounds like they're so legalistic, and they're, as soon as you hear them, you're bound to think up loopholes. And I think there's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't be good for like an overarching philosophy. For one, they view robots as like tools rather than potentially brothers and sisters or like a new intelligent species. So in order to like come up with a guiding philosophy, we need to think a lot harder. And we're just beginning to do that. And I think that the three laws is a good starting point to see the errors in a lot of the thinking in the past. And I think that we need more than just science fiction authors looking at some of these issues. Those help too.
Well, how do you get into this field of artificial intelligence? You know, if you're in high school now and you're reading Cory Doctorow and, Werner Vinge, what kind of courses would you want to take? Where would you want to go? I mean, it seems like you could go a lot of different directions to end up at this destination.
Because I think that artificial intelligence is the greatest challenge that the human race has ever faced. In its complexity, you're getting to study a lot of different fields. And I think one of the most important places to start is studying the human brain and neuroscience, because you won't understand like the scale of complexity that's necessary for intelligence until you understand the scale of complexity that exists in the human brain. And in the same way, it'll also dispel some of the mystery that people have about the human brain. A lot of people look at it as a black box, but in reality, we know a tremendous amount about it.
We do now. It's really become a lot clearer as we've developed these various imaging technologies that show us what, you know, the electrical activity happening in the brain. But to counterweight all this, there has to be some kind of spiritual component, doesn't there? Some kind of a philosophical ethic, an almost, I would say, religious a perception of what intelligence is.
I would call it philosophical, mm-hmm. metaphysical framing. Mm-hmm. And that comes into these questions all the time because a lot of people are skeptical of the notion that human intelligence could be duplicated in a machine. And this engenders constant debate, and it's worthwhile. And I think that if you're going to create an AI, what might be most useful before you even write your first line of code is the philosophical framing of how you're going to approach it and how you believe, what you believe intelligence is, what it's used for, and all that. And it's so mysterious and complex to us now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be mysterious and complex forever. Everything else in the universe, especially like life, chemistry, physics, we've come to understand better and better, and I think that we'll do that for intelligence too, but it'll be an uphill climb.
Let's talk about some of the philosophical aspects of intelligence and the ethical aspects of developing this. I mean, this sounds like a cross between coding and logic, you know, games.
Yeah, one of the questions that comes up sometimes is the definition of consciousness. Mm-hmm. That is always an issue. And
do we have one?
No. People mean completely different things by it. I think someone was able to compile like 50 different definitions of consciousness. By some definitions of consciousness, a camera pointed to a mirror that records footage of itself is self-aware and therefore conscious, which is just silly, you know? Mm-hmm. So one of the philosophical issues is to what extent is intelligence correlated with consciousness and what is consciousness and are they necessary for one another? And in the domain of ethics, you have to, in order to create an artificial agent that behaves in what we consider to be a kind or benevolent way, you have to ask, what is it that makes human beings behave in a kind and benevolent way at all? And that goes into evolutionary biology and philosophy and ethics. And it seems why I actually feel optimistic that some of our views about artificial intelligence will be confirmed is that the notion that human values are complex. To us, they seem simple. It seems intuitive to like help someone on the side of a road who's hurt or something. But in reality, that the set of mental features that allow us to do stuff like that evolved over many thousands of years. I mean, worms aren't altruistic to one another. And there's many animals out in the wild where they are not altruistic to one another because there was no evolutionary pressure for them to be so. But when it comes to human beings, there is a pressure for us to be selectively altruistic, where if someone has a benefit to us, we are kind to them and vice versa. And sometimes we aren't even conscious of what's happening. We might think we're being kind to others for its own sake, but maybe it's just for social signaling or for status reasons or for reciprocation anticipated in the future. So in order to create an artificial intelligence that we can actually trust, we have to say, what are the computational and mathematical and philosophical features that go into
compassion.
Yeah, exactly. And that is an issue that's been debated for thousands of years.
Yeah, I recently spoke with a religious scholar, Karen Armstrong, who looked at the history of science and religion and talks about compassion as being the core value of all religions. And I don't think we've got about to deciphering that, programming that. You know, there's no a computer program for compassion yet, is there?
We have to teach compassion to a rock, basically. That's what friendly artificial intelligence should be.
And that sounds like a fairly difficult process. How close are we to that?
Closer than many people might think.
Really?
Well, there have been certain experiments that delineate some aspects of where altruism comes from. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's a strategy called tit for tat that was influential among Cold War diplomats, which is the notion of a computer scientist created these artificial like little entities who were just a few pixels wide, and they interacted in a simulated environment, and they had the option to either cooperate or defect on one another in their interactions. And he found that a strategy called tit for tat dominated, which is the notion of help others, but if they defect on you, never help them again. So other strategies like always help others would fail, because then those entities would be exploited. And not helping others at all also fails, because there's no one to cooperate with you. So they found that this place in the middle evolved naturally just in a computer program. So it tells us that at least some features of compassion might be computationally simple, but we don't, it seems as if human values in general are extremely computationally complex, and we can learn a lot about them by studying, I think, evolutionary psychology.
Well, what kind of, when you say studying evolutionary psychology, what is evolutionary psychology, and how do we study it in terms of programming the forthcoming artificial intelligence?
That's a difficult question. Well, for instance, studies have shown that human beings like rolling grasslands with a few trees here and there and some water in the distance. And it's not just arbitrary. It's not because that environment is inherently good, because the environment isn't necessarily inherently anything. It's because that's the sort of environment where we would be most able to see predators coming, number mm-hmm. one, and have access to water, which we need to survive, and be able to see our prey. So it's a difficult area where piecing together the environment in which we evolved. Evolutionary psychology means looking at human psychology as the product of our evolutionary history. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that we have analyzed animals for centuries, and in the last like two or three decades, it's emerged as a academic field of its own. And it's basically the notion that the way we think is to a large degree because of the adaptive problems that our minds were primed to solve.
And these are the solutions we created on the African savanna with the help of some black monoliths.
Yeah, and the question is, do we want to pass along all of those solutions to our mind children, you could call it, or do we want to maybe withhold some of the nastier aspects of human nature?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that religious scholars, spiritual scholars, and people like that do have something to contribute to that discussion, certainly.
Well, one of the things that really interests me about the Singularity Institute is how wide, you know, your grasp is. We hear artificial intelligence and we think, you know, guys on the internet and computers and stuff. But I think it's really interesting how human focused this whole idea is.
Given that humans are the only existence, proof of intelligence, compassion, anything, yeah, we might call it the Human Institute for Artificial Intelligence because of the way that we look at humans as a starting point.
Now, if humans are a starting point, and this singularity beyond which we can't even imagine what history will be like is the end point, you talk about yourself, you believe that there's a single event. You believe that somewhere, you personally believe that somewhere out there, in the future, there's a computer that's going to, or something like a computer, or maybe a human being, that's going to wake up.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that, event? And it's interesting, too, and it's important to remember that, you know, you mentioned that enhanced humans, because science fiction has a long tradition of humans who make themselves as gods, and this is, you know, before there was this notion of computers, there was this notion of, you know, I guess this guy's name was Friedrich Nietzsche, the Superman.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, yeah, Nietzsche's philosophy has been so tarnished by it being co-opted by the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a connection between some of the work being done at the Singularity Institute and a philosophical movement called transhumanism.
Mm-hmm. Explain what this is. This is a really interesting movement.
It's the idea that human beings are basically just a starting point on our journey through the cosmos and history, and that just because we were born into the human species doesn't necessarily mean that we'll want to retain our current forms forever. And we see ourselves modifying our daily lives and routines with technology. And I think that's just merely the first steps towards unlimited self-modification, that AIs and enhanced human beings will be the first examples of new intelligences, which I find fascinating.
Well, unfortunately, thus far, the human race's attempts to modify itself. I've read some articles recently about how we've domesticated ourselves and really kind of, you know, made ourselves worse. Is it possible that we won't reach the singularity because we'll have dumbed ourselves down to the point where if we get a singularity, it might be like Archie?
I certainly hope not, but it's true, like humans do seem to be like, I was speaking earlier today about how certain mammalian species seem to be continued adolescence of other species, mm-hmm. so almost as if human beings are like a chimpanzee adolescent that keeps going on forever, and I think that the one way that we can avoid that is by using technology not just to solve our problems for us, but also to challenge ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think technology can lead to new challenges that we never had to cope with before, intellectual challenges. And I think that we have to just keep challenging ourselves or we will become weaker and weaker, just like you're saying, there's a danger of.
Well, I mean, it strikes me that a technology that created a huge ethical challenge and moral challenge and a social challenge was that of nuclear weaponry. Because once we created that, we could have blowed up the world about 50 years ago without a problem and extinguished all human life. We haven't managed to do that yet, but it's still on the table.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important reasons to look at artificial intelligence because of its potential to do that. And I also think that the connection between nuclear weapons and artificial intelligence is a really good metaphor, because with nuclear weapons, you're also talking about a critical mass and a chain reaction. Mm-hmm. I think it could be the same thing with artificial intelligence programs. That's why I tell you that I think it'll be somewhat of a discrete event, because I think we'll reach a critical mass of self-improving intelligence and we'll shoot off faster than we anticipate in advance.
There'll be an AI Day of Trinity, in other words.
Yes, and the sooner in advance we start preparing for it, the better. That's why I don't think that the singularity needs to be like 20, 30, or 40 years off for it to be important. Even if it were 500 years off, it would be the biggest thing in the universe that's happened since the emergence of the human species. So that's why I think it's worth analyzing, even if we don't have all the pieces yet.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know if when we blew up the nuke that it wasn't going to set the Earth's atmosphere on fire, which was Fermi was quite afeard of that.
I know, and the way
we went and did it anyway.
I know, because of pressures like military, the need for a weapon, and that's why I'm concerned that artificial intelligence will meet the same fate, where it's created as part of a military project, and the creators will just sweep aside the safety issues to get like a powerful new weapon. That's why I think it's extremely important for a nonprofit to be the first to create artificial intelligence that is explicitly designed with all of humans' interests and needs in mind.
And you're part of that nonprofit at the core, which puts you kind of at the center of the future. And I'm wondering if you're here, sitting here in Santa Cruz in a T-shirt on a pleasant winter evening, thinking about, you know, somewhere down the line, you know, the what happens when they're talking about the Asimov reaction and
I don't know. Like, I blog a lot, so I get a lot of responses to my writing as it is, which is, you know, really exciting. I love to interact with people that read my stuff. And, yeah, I really do think I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it were important for the future of humanity.
Now, what's next for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence? There's a summit in 2010. So tell us a little bit what you can about that.
In 2010, we're going to have a Singularity Summit on the West Coast in the Bay Area, and we're going to be focusing on artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, futurism, a lot of the same issues that we focused on prior summits. And also, we are consolidating all of our staff in the Bay Area, and as I mentioned earlier, we are operating a visiting fellows program. So any, let's see, graduate students or undergrads in computer science, philosophy, cognitive science, any of those areas that they think might be relevant to the work we're doing, I strongly encourage you to Google Singularity Institute and get in contact with us on our website, and we can forward you to our call for visiting fellows, because we're really interested in bringing people through and writing scientific papers, doing research, and just getting them involved in the work that we're doing.
The father of the future AI may be listening to us even as we speak. And they should go to singinst.org. That's singinst.org. That's your website.
Yeah, and it's totally true. I think that the people that might create artificial intelligence are probably really young today, so there could be young geniuses out there right now. Don't hesitate. Please get in touch with us. We need you to help us save the world.
I've been speaking with Michael Asimov. He's the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Thank you for joining me, Michael.
Thanks.
This has been a blast. Thank you. You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.